I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Black Lives Matter first got organized after the death of Trayvon Martin, shot by George Zimmerman 3 years ago. More recently, members of the movement have been challenging presidential candidates, including Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Jeb Bush. Today, we take a look at the movement, its demands, tactics, and the effect its message appears to be having on the presidential election. And we'll begin with one of the officers of the Philadelphia chapter of Black Lives Matter, Melanie McCoy. She's a student at Temple University, in fact, finishing up her senior year, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Melanie McCoy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. What are the goals of Black Lives Matter? What are the goals?
So the goals, one of the things, of course, first, in terms of militarization of, you know, the, you know, police departments around, we want to definitely, you know, we want to kind of dismantle that. That's just something that's very important to Black Lives Matter. In addition to that, and I'm going to kind of go down the list.
Sure.
But in addition to that, aside from that, one of the goals also is to figure out a way to have less police, you know, on the street. Now, here's the thing. It's not just, let me think. In terms nationally, it's just a bit differently. So it goes a little bit different. So aside from the demands nationally, locally, people have demands as well. So here in Philadelphia.
In the Philadelphia
area. Yeah, so Philadelphia has, I would say we have a very unique experience here, especially since a lot of us are familiar with things such as the MOVE situation that took place several years ago. We even in terms of Mumia Abu-Jamal, regardless of how people feel about him, you know, some people believe that he's, a cop killer. We do not believe that, you know, here. And one of the things, especially like recently, I know some people have gotten word and received word that he's very ill. So that's one of the concerns that we have. But one of the things that is very unique about the chapter here, and which is very unique about the movement within itself, is that we live by the mantra of Black Lives Mattering. So this means that all Black lives matter. You know, I know people have had this thing where they want to say all lives matter, but it's kind of like we're here to set the record straight. This isn't about other lives not mattering. But when we live in a world where, you know, people are constantly being murdered and killed just for just being who you are. And this is deeper than just skin color. You know, lighter skinned people are dying. Darker skinned people are dying. So we're just here to set the record straight. Trans people are dying. So here in Philadelphia, we want to make sure that we create safe spaces and havens. And as we want to provide justice for those who are black and disabled, black trans, especially black trans women. There was a woman not too long ago, a black trans woman, who was murdered here. Her name was London Chanel. Right in North Philly, she was murdered. So black men, black women, especially black women, because of the erasure that that's been taking place, especially several years ago, we want to make sure that black women are placed and they're recognized for the people who we are. And we're leaders.
If a white person wanted to join the Philadelphia chapter of Black Lives Matter, could they do that? And I asked that the NAACP has allowed white people to join. Can white people join Black Lives Matter?
No. Now, here's the thing.
Okay.
What I will say is nationally, there are chapters that do accept white people. Here in Philadelphia, we do not do that. It is actually for safety reasons and for reasons of protection. Also, aside from that, when we're talking about what should be done with black lives and how things should be handled, it's a bit inappropriate and unrealistic to expect to have these conversations with people who are not black. Even if you are a non-black person of color, there shouldn't be other people having a say in how we live our lives and how we navigate. Now, if people want to offer tips and suggestions, they could ally with our movements. But the problem is here, we do have an issue with how allies operate here in this city.
The idea that allies would tell you what to do, is that what you're saying?
Yes. 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 Co-opting, all that.
Let me ask you about, because I think a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters have been surprised and a little shocked that Black Lives Matter has targeted him a couple of times. His supporters say, look, there's no one more progressive running for president than Bernie Sanders. He has marched for civil rights. You know, why would Black Lives Matter target a candidate like him that probably believes most of what Black Lives Matter does believe? What's your answer to that?
My answer is black people target Obama as well. So why should a white man be any different? Here's the thing. As progressive as Bernie Sanders is, he still is going to be the president of a country that is known for its violence. We started with violence. This is how the United States has formed. We are formed on the violence of black people and the murders of black people, as well as the native people who lived here. So I know that people are saying that Black Lives Matter, we should, hear him out. But I think that we should be holding everyone accountable. I think that Bernie Sanders, it's kind of like here's the thing. When you put yourself out there as a person that claims to be more progressive, you're setting yourself up for critique. And I think that everyone warrants critique. So I think that the two black women that we saw in Seattle, I think that their points were very valid. Their names were Marissa Johnson and Mara Williford. And I know that these women are catching heat. I know that there are some Black Lives Matter people saying that we're trying to support him. And there are others that are saying, no, we might need to look into this further. But I think that as a white male who's trying to run within a very important role here in this country, that it must be discussed that we're still putting our faith and our hopes and our trust in someone that does not look like us.
What is your stance? How do you feel about President Obama? Has he represented your position, your points of view as a black man?
No. I would say no. Here's the thing. I love his family. Like, I adore them. I think that they're absolutely adorable. But at the same time, when it comes right down to it, he's still a black person who was in a very high, sense of leadership here in this country. And I don't think that he was able to do everything that, people anticipated for him to do. But I will say, I'm not shocked. Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that some of the things didn't get done. I think that he took he was trying to tread lightly with his words. And I understand, I think that he was trying really hard to be in our favor. But in other times, I think that he could have stood up for himself a little bit more, but it just didn't happen.
Looking at the organization here in Philly and even at other members of Black Lives Matter, do you believe in the political process? Are you interested in the two mainstream parties, whether it's Democrat or Republican? Does that interest you at all? I mean, I realize targeting campaigns is a way certainly to get a lot of attention and to put pressure on them.
Right. I feel that there's definitely interest, but I also think it's about the roles in which people play. And I think that people are often confused because, this is a very millennial-led movement. So because we think of how millennials operate, people say that we're very entitled. Some people say that that's one of our flaws. One of the things that people do like about us is that we speak our minds. But in speaking our minds, sometimes we have this thing where people are very individual. And that's something that I think that this movement is trying to kind of work through. Because here it is, I come from a very African-centered frame of thought. And many of the people in Black Lives Matter here in the Philadelphia chapter do. We have people like Taylor, who was actually the founder here of the Philadelphia chapter, and another sister named Ajere Gary, who she still remains in contact with us. But here, we wanted to make sure that people had this understanding that with our, African-centered mindset, that individualism is just not going to work, especially in the African-centered context. So you think community. I think that we're all individuals, but we have to realize that we are individuals that are communal.
What do you make about Dr. Ben Carson? Obviously, he's running for president as a Republican. He's an African-American himself. Is there something about his message that speaks?
I think that Ben Carson, for many people, growing up, he was the person that you would see in the textbook as the first person who did X, Y, and Z. I think he should have just left it at that.
Stayed a brain surgeon?
Yes, remain a brain surgeon, because now I'm looking at the textbook and I'm like, you know what? Do you really want to tarnish your image in that way? Do you really want us to rip your name out of the textbook for speaking nonsense and craziness? And, I think it's really ironic and crazy. Do you really want to do this to yourself right now? Have you lost your mind?
What do you think about some of the female candidates? There are two of them, Carly Fiorina and Hillary Clinton. As you mentioned here in Philadelphia, it feels like a very sort of female-centric part of Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
Do they address some of your concerns?
No, I'm a black woman. Absolutely.
Because they're white?
Yes, absolutely. Let's start with just the idea of just white women in general.
And you're talking to one,
just
so you know.
Okay. Absolutely. So, and I recognize that, and it's important. So here in Black Lives Matter, again, we're very strategic in that many of us are black feminist and womanist thinkers. So some of us consider us the daughters of, Alice Walkers and the Bell Hooks and the Audre Lordes. And we revere them very, high. So one of the things that we often talk about is sometimes I think there's a totem pole here. And black women have this very interesting effect on the world. Sometimes we are seen as some of the most invisible people in this world. But at times, we're also the butt of everyone's joke. So it's like we're invisible, but somehow very visible all at once. People make fun of us. They do all sorts of things. We have the whole angry black woman stereotype. But here's the thing. When it comes down to it, you have white men, white women, and this is in order, black men, and then black women. And so when we recognize these things, we think about, as womanist thinkers, what best represents us and our ideologies? And one of those things is that feminism, I know that Hillary Clinton is like, oh, feminism, awesome. But feminism, and I like to preface it in front as white feminism, because it doesn't speak to what black women have experienced. And we're talking about black women of all different kinds, whether it be black trans women, whether it be cis hetero, heterosexual black women, or whether it be a lesbian black woman, whoever this person is, or a queer black woman, they do not speak to our concerns. So I think it's important to realize that, I'm hearing, I think it was at the Oscars, one of the women was just trying to rally black women to get on. It was ridiculous. And I was just like, I don't understand. So with white women, their role is that we feel that we're constantly being erased. And our concerns, I said, there's being a woman and then there's being a black woman. And we're intersectional. We're a living example of what intersectionality looks like. And Hillary Clinton does not embody that.
We're almost out of time here. Is there one thing that you're looking for to address some of the concerns that you just raised? Someone to say something? Who speaks? I mean, obviously you speak for yourself. Is it important to have a leader or no?
No. I think that it's important to know that here at Black Lives Matter, especially here in Philadelphia, is that we want to share the leadership. We want to make sure that everyone is represented, and we want to make sure that everyone is visible. So right here, right now, I'm Melanie McCoy, but at the same time, I'm also Black Lives Matter. And I want to make sure that everyone who is a part of Black Lives Matter is represented in some way, shape, or form. All of our lives matter. So.
We have to end on that note. Melanie McCoy, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. One of the officers of the Philadelphia chapter of Black Lives Matter. We're going to take a very short break, and then we have two guests waiting in the wings carrying on our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about Black Lives Matter in this hour of Radio Times, as you know, challenging some of the presidential contenders this election cycle, frankly, taking them to task for their lack of proposals to address racism in America as they see it. We're taking a look at the movement, discussing its origins, demands, tactics, message. And joining us now are James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, also Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, a regular contributor to MSNBC and thegrio.com. You can also hear his WHYY podcast, The Remix, and probably by now a regular contributor to Radio Times as well. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Ralph Young, professor of history at Temple University, author of a book called Dissent, The History of an American Idea. In fact, teaches a course called Dissent in America. Ralph Young, it's been 11 years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good, thank you.
We were all listening, or you were listening as I was talking with our first guest, with Melanie. And Ralph, do you sense or hear shades of previous civil rights movements or protest movements?
Oh, yes, yes. A lot of what she was saying, of course, reminded me a lot of when the Black Power movement began in, the aftermath of some of the civil rights demonstrations that Martin Luther King led. But, you know, she's just speaking from that long tradition of American descent, you know, and I always tell my students, you know, America was founded by dissenters. We put the right to dissent in the First Amendment of the Constitution. And Americans have been dissenting ever since, and people have been fighting for rights. You mean, one of the things we did is we have these high ideals. You know, we say all men are created equal. Everybody has these rights. And so many groups have felt disenfranchised, disempowered, and they've been fighting, you know, since the founding of this country. You know, feminist women fighting for the right to vote, abolitionists against slavery, civil rights activists. You just name it.
Part of a long tradition.
Part of a long tradition, yes.
And James, it's interesting that it grew out of the death of Trayvon Martin, which was a little more than 3 years ago.
Right.
And since then have really looked at or targeted, you know, police shooting of, in many cases or number of cases, unarmed black men. Do you see them as sort of carrying on that part of the movement today?
It's interesting to think about corollaries and examples of the kind of rhetoric and the actions that we see coming from the Black Lives Matter movement. It is, I think, more akin to sort of the Black Power, Black Arts movement maybe than it is to civil rights for a lot of different reasons, certainly in rhetoric. But I feel like, you know, what's happening is that you have millennials, mostly millennials of color, you know, when they saw Zimmerman exonerated, it seemed like the state was complicit in the murder of a young black person. And then if you think about what's happened over the last 3 years, you've seen Zimmerman get into all sorts of trouble with the law. I mean, I don't even know how many times this guy has obviously shown that he's a bad actor in civil society. But also we've seen a steady string of either state sanctioned or state complicit murders of black folks. And then in addition to that, this is why the intersectional piece is so important, Martin. In addition to that, we've seen black trans folks and we've seen black women also be murdered, but not, you know, their names and their cases are not risen to the level of the black males that have been murdered. It's horrible to think about making those comparisons, but Black Lives Matter is here to make sure that we do. And this is why the founders of the movement, the three women who founded the movement, and many of the leaders across the nation are deeply invested in the hashtag Say Her Name and in the movement to get Black Trans Lives Matters and All Black Lives Matters to sort of be a part of what the mantra is of the organization of the movement.
And I asked Melanie about some of the disruptions or protests at Bernie Sanders rallies. And I do want to play a clip, and this is from a rally on August 8th. Leaders of the Seattle branch of Black Lives Matter, Marissa Johnson, Mara Williford, essentially arguing with a Bernie Sanders rally organizer, a guy named Robbie Stern. Let's give it a listen.
All right, so we are trying to be reasonable. We are trying to be reasonable. We are trying to be reasonable.
We are reasonable.
We are trying. We're going to give you, we're going to let you on the mic. We are going to give you the mic. We will, after Senator Sanders. After Senator Sanders. After Senator Sanders. After Senator Sanders. After Senator Sanders.
Do not tell me what to do.
After Senator Sanders.
Sit down.
After Senator Sanders.
Sit down.
Okay. All right.
Let her speak.
All right.
Let her speak.
All right.
We're
shutting it down. You are shutting it down. You are disrupting this event. You are disrupting this event. We will.
That's on his campaign.
Let her speak.
No, you are shutting it down. We are shutting.
Let her speak or we shut it down.
We will shut it down. You are shutting it down.
And again, an excerpt of the Seattle branch of Black Lives Matter at a rally for Bernie Sanders. As you listen to that, Ralph, what do you hear?
Tremendous frustration. And, you know, and this is one of the things that has happened. You know, when the civil rights movement had its success with overthrowing the Jim Crow laws, for many African Americans, they saw no real change in the society, certainly not in the North, certainly not in urban ghettos. And there's been increasing frustration over the years and frustration against the white backlash against the civil rights movement, which is kind of represented by, you know, the getting tough on crime, the mass incarceration issues. And, you know, African-American men especially have been killed by the police, unarmed men by the police you know, ever since the civil rights movement, even before that. And I think, you know, it's just the tremendous amount of frustration that has built up and built up.
James, I mean, the criticism, you've heard it, is, mm-hmm. is, you know, why target someone like Bernie Sanders, who's probably, you know, as radical as you're going to get as a presidential candidate, who has cared and marched for civil rights.
Of course.
But why him?
Why not? Why not? Right. I mean, so it seems as if the easy targets seem to be Trump or Rand Paul or the folks on the right, people who have used racial dog whistles or have conservative politics. But that doesn't make good political or strategic sense for a number of different reasons. One, their crowds aren't as big. Two, people make the critique. Why not Hillary Clinton? Well, her security is different. She has, you know, Secret Service there. So from an activist organizational standpoint, Bernie Sanders makes a lot of sense. His crowds are bigger than anyone else's. And because he is the guy who is leftist and progressive, he is the appropriate target. Because remember, a lot of progressives feel as if the Democratic Party has drifted way too far to the right, that American politics have drifted way too far towards a regressive sort of entrenchment. And the response to that from activists and organizers is to actually let's get the left wing and make sure it actually is a left wing. It makes sense to me for the numbers that are there, for the positions that Bernie Sanders holds. And look at what the outcome has been.
Well,
look at how much we're talking about it. Look at what Bernie Sanders did to change his platform. He hired a very high-ranking African-American woman into his campaign. You can't argue with the results of what they've done.
Well, I thought what was interesting is Robbie Stern, who's the rally organizer, says, we're trying to be reasonable here. And the women say, well, we're not reasonable.
No, how can we be reasonable if every 28 hours an unarmed person is being murdered by the police?
But what does it have to do with Bernie Sanders? That's what I'm struggling to understand.
So here's the thing. So Bernie Sanders has the rhetoric of saying, I'm a progressive, right? If you're going to be representing progressives, the Black Lives Matter movement is a progressive movement. They're ensuring that they're being represented. And here's the thing. I'm not sure we would be talking about these issues if Black Lives Matter hadn't interjected them into the public discourse. And I'm sorry, but Bernie Sanders' campaign ended up being the most strategically pragmatic target, and I think it worked.
But I'm not here representing Bernie Sanders or his campaign. Yeah. But you know, he talks about income inequality.
Absolutely.
He talks about criminal justice. He talks about, you know, the fight for racial justice, for economic justice. Does that not resonate?
It does resonate, and it resonates more now because he's interpolated the things that Black Lives Matter has pushed into. Remember, we could square economic inequality, and there would still be racial economic inequality.
The difference between racial inequality and economic inequality.
Right. There is some overlap, right? But you could, let's say if we close the wealth gap, right, if we looked at what black wealth is, you can tell that there's still a racialized component to it. So to talk about economic justice without talking about race, Black Lives Matter, it's all about the intersectionality piece. It's about holding those things in the sort of eye of the prize at the same time. And again, protest isn't pretty. As Professor Young will say, it's never pretty. It's not comfortable. So many white progressives are really upset with the Black Lives Matter movement because they feel like Bernie Sanders is a champion of progressive ideals. He is, but I'm sorry, the Black Lives Matter movement is making him better.
Well, and it also shows, Ralph, a kind of a disconnect perhaps among progressives over candidates
and a place like Seattle. I don't know if people are familiar with Seattle, but there are not a lot of black folks there. There are a lot of progressive folks there, but a lot of racial issues get left out. If you speak to the Native American community there, if you speak to the Latino community, the African American community, race is often left out of progressive politics. And so Seattle is actually a great place for that kind of conversation to happen.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. Well, they obviously want all of the political parties to address the issues that they're concerned with. And it kind of reveals the fact that basically in the United States, all of the political parties from day one have been complicit in racism, have been, you know, supportive of the system. And you might get some progressives, and we've had some progressive presidents like FDR, for example, who really did nothing about doing something about the lynchings that were going on in the South, even though there were a lot of people pushing for an anti-lynching legislation. You know, he had various political reasons for not doing that. And so it becomes very you know, clear that people are just so frustrated with the fact that our system is stuck in this inertia, that it doesn't move forward.
Does it also explain some of the frustration people have with President Obama, which is that he hasn't been able to do the things that he said he wanted to do, or perhaps the things that his voters wanted him to do?
Right. You know, and of course, he's run into some terrible roadblocks in with opposition in Congress. But, you know, Obama is perhaps not quite as progressive as most people thought when they voted for him. He's somewhat of a moderate Democrat.
And James Peterson is chuckling knowingly.
He's a centrist, he's moderate, and he's a pragmatist. And that's, you know, in these times, that's a very complicated position for the first black president to be in.
And that's James Peterson, who joins us along with Ralph Young. We're talking about Black Lives Matter, and it looks like we got a lot of comments here. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can call us as well, 1-888-477-9499. What do you make of the Black Lives Matter movement? I do want to play another clip, and this is Julius Jones, founder of Black Lives Matter Worcester, or Worcester, I'm not sure how to say that, confronting Hillary Clinton. This is backstage at an event in New Hampshire. This is August 17th. And this is about President Clinton's signing of the crime bill, which ended up increasing the number of African Americans in prison. And I should say to our listeners, just lightly edited, let's give it a listen.
I genuinely want to know, you and your family have been, in no uncertain way, partially responsible for this, more than most. Now, there may have been unintended consequences, but now that you understand the consequences, what in your heart has changed that's going to change the direction of this country? Mm-hmm. Like, what in you, like, not your platform, mm-hmm. not what you're supposed to say. Like, how do you actually feel that's different than you did before? Like, what were the mistakes, and how can those mistakes that you made be lessons for all of America? For a moment of reflection on how we treat black people mm-hmm. in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously it's a very thoughtful question that deserves a thoughtful answer. But you're going to have to come together as a movement and say, here's what we want done about it. Because you can get lip service from as many white people as you can pack into Yankee Stadium and mm-hmm. a million more like it. We're going to say, oh, we get it. We're going to be nicer, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. That's not enough, at least right. in my book. That's not how I see mm-hmm. politics. So the consciousness raising, the advocacy, the passion, the youth of your movement is so critical. But now all I'm suggesting is, even for us sinners, find some common ground on agendas that can make a difference right here and now in people's lives. And that's what I would love to, you know, have your thoughts about, because that's what I'm trying to figure out how to do.
And Hillary Clinton also said, I don't believe you change hearts. I believe you change laws. You change allocations of resources. You change the way systems operate. And James, I have to say, before I heard that clip, I read descriptions of it, and it was this angry exchange between right. Black Lives Matter and Hillary Clinton. Not angry at all.
No. I mean, I kind of, in some ways, I wish the cameras weren't rolling so they could have had a kind of a different kind of conversation. I don't really like the question, and I don't really like the answer, right? So, because I also am less interested in how people feel about other people and more interested in what the systems are at play and what the structures are at play and how do we change those. But Secretary Clinton had an opportunity to talk about how she felt, and she should have done that and said what she needed to say. Now, where she went wrong was exactly what Melanie was talking about. You know, so as an ally, when you try to dictate to an organization what they should and shouldn't do, the paternalism that is sort of inherent in those kinds of comments unfortunately disrupts the conversation and disrupts a capacity to have an open sort of dialogue about what can and cannot happen. So I feel like I wish the question would have been different, but I also wish that Secretary Clinton had given a better answer.
What did you hear, Ralph?
Well, pretty much the same thing. That I thought the question was not that bad, and that she gave a fairly thoughtful response. Although there was obviously a little gap there where she spent
edited.
A time
yeah.
thinking.
Well, we didn't edit out like crazy, you know, screaming or yelling right. or anything like that.
And I think that she would make the effort if she's elected president to do something, but whether whatever she tries to put into play will work, That's another question. And there's so much opposition that'll still be in Congress.
Exactly. One of the reasons why her affective response is important here is because what they're talking about is we know better now what the consequences of mass incarceration is. So we talk about the treatment of black folks. There's a very specific way in which the Clinton administration was, you know, implicated in ramping up the mass incarceration effort. It's decimated families, it's decimated communities, and it's most pronounced in the communities of Baltimore, Charleston, Ferguson, right? When you look at Ferguson, that is a microcosm of the worst practices of the prison industrial complex. And so she could have taken an opportunity to say, this is awful. This is destroying families. She could have had an affective response to it. But she needed to do that in conjunction with the systemic response.
But yeah. What's interesting is we're beginning to see, Ralph, a number of people, including some Republicans who are rethinking this crime bill, saying we're spending a lot of money, we're not getting much for it, and it looks like we're hurting communities, including a lot of black communities.
Yes, and I think it's become clear to everybody that this mass incarceration issue, especially for people that have been thrown into prison for really fairly minor offenses and, you know, long, extravagant sentences for this. And, you know, I think maybe a lot of politicians are beginning to ask themselves also that here we are 1 year after Ferguson, but 50 years after Watts, and what has changed? You know, and it just kind of underscores the feeling of alienation that so many African Americans have, that, you know, nothing is happening to change the situation. There's, you know, maybe we have a black president, but it's not enough.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Ralph Young. He's a professor of history at Temple University, wrote a book called Dissent, The History of an American Idea. Also with us is James Peterson, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. He also has a podcast here at WHYY called The Remix, and we are talking about Black Lives Matter. We got a lot of people to join the conversation, and we have another clip to play, Ben Carson talking about Black Lives Matter. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are looking at, talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, its demands, its tactics, its message. And again, our guests are James Peterson and Ralph Young. Let me play another clip, and this is Dr. Ben Carson, as you know, running for president as a Republican, expounding on his anti-Black Lives Matter op-ed that appeared in USA Today earlier this week on Monday.
Actually, there are a lot of people in the black community who actually think the way that I do, but it's very risky to actually say it, because then you'll be called a name, you'll be scorned, and that is what the established progressive party wants. They don't want anybody to speak out against this. And they want to demonize anybody who does so because they want to maintain their power. And I think a lot of people are starting to wake up. I'm not sure they're going to be able to maintain this grasp over the black community going into the future. I'm certainly hoping that's the case.
Let me just read a little bit of what he said in his op-ed. He said, I grew up in neighborhoods most Americans were told never to drive through. I saw bullets, drugs, and death in the same places. I played tag and ball with my friends. Both of my older cousins died on the streets where I lived. I thought that was my destiny, but my mother didn't. She changed all of that. She saved my brother and me from being killed on those streets with nothing but a library card. What do you make of what Ben Carson is saying, James?
Well, Dr. Carson's story is an amazing story. He's an amazing surgeon. But as a politician, I think he leaves a lot to be desired. And so the idea that black folk are silenced by progressives, or that progressives are silenced by the Black Lives Matter, that's absurd. Where is he? I mean, there's so much uproar. There's so many black folks who disagree with Black Lives Matter. There's so much arguing and debate and discussion going on within the movement itself. There's so many white folks who are critiquing the Black Lives Matter from the left. I mean, it just seems it's preposterous to even respond to it, because it's just wholly inaccurate, and there's so much data and evidence to suggest the counterfact. But what I would say to him is, if there's so many black folks who agree with you, produce those black folks. Show us where they are, because everything else you're saying in there is just not true.
Go ahead, Ralph, and then we'll get to some callers and some comments.
Well, even if he's, you know, accurate, whether he's accurate or not in his assessment of all this, the fact is that it's doing something that dissenters have always done, is that they're raising the dialogue, they're raising questions, and they're getting people to talk about it, to debate about it. It was like, you know, with the Occupy movement, you know, which sort of flopped after a while, but it got everybody talking about income inequality. Nobody was talking about it.
It's Bernie Sanders' whole campaign.
Yeah.
And off the Occupy, yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's just part of the, you know, what dissent is all about. You want to get the discussion out there and people debating and calling each other names even.
Let me see what Chris from Devon has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, it's very frustrating listening to this program. I have to say, I have a slightly different perspective. You know, I think that most of the responsibility for the impression in the country that black lives don't matter comes from the actions and the behaviors of the black people themselves. I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, you have these single black girls who start having babies and they're 17, 18. They have three or four babies, don't have a job, can't support them, can't educate them, aren't educated themselves. You have football players who have six different girlfriends, and you know, a kid with each of those girlfriends. They don't support them. They walk out on them. They go, who's going to raise those kids? And then you have the black on black crime. You know, there's a it's their own society that sort of from the root of the problem is that when they start having babies before they're financially prepared, before they're, you know, they have themselves established, and then they become. Poor, and their children are disenfranchised.
We hear you, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Okay. I know James Peterson wants to say something in response.
The most predictable response to the Black Lives Matter movement, or any time the movement tries to raise issues around police or law enforcement brutality, is black-on-black crime. It's absurd for a number of different reasons. One, there's no such thing as black-on-black crime. Almost all crime is committed intra-racially. People commit crimes with people in their communities. So something like 83 to 85% of all crime is intra-racially committed.
So white killing whites.
Yes, and black killing blacks. And the response to the what they call black-on-black crime has been pronounced for decades. And the thing is, people don't see it. It's when we're talking about gun control, when we're talking about education, when we're talking about the social safety net, when we're talking about concentrated crime in the city of Philadelphia. That is the way that you root out violence in our communities. But see, you can't mark that as a racialized discussion, but we've been fighting those battles for decades. Literally, to suggest that we're not outraged about the violence in our own communities is offensive. Now, we can have a whole show about teen pregnancy, okay? But teen pregnancy is not a black thing. But for folks who are concerned about it, look at the data on it. It's been in decline since the 90s, almost three decades of decline in so-called teen pregnancy. So again, these are red herrings and straw men, but it's sad that how predictable that response is.
Sad?
Yep. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a very predictable response.
Let me read a couple of emails from Tony. He says, a Glenn Ford at the Black Gender Report recently wrote that Black Lives Matter is rife for co-optation and on the brink of failure because it isn't making any demands, just putting out talking points, and he goes on from there. If you're talking about a movement, just how organized does it have to be? It seems that Black Lives Matter is rather decentralized. We heard from the, you know, one of the leaders here in the Philadelphia area.
Right. Yes. And Melanie.
And I guess the question is, how do you sustain a movement?
Well, that's the million-dollar question all the time. And, it was like with Occupy Wall Street again. They didn't have any kind of centralization at all, and they were proud of that. And Melanie was telling me before we went on air that she's very proud of that fact with Black Lives Matter in Philadelphia, that it is no one particular person is the leader. But it does seem to me, in just the history of dissent, that movements that wind up having more success, there are people that you do have to have some kind of organization, some kind of leadership qualities to it.
That you need like a sort of single leader or at least someone who can represent the movement in all its...
Right. Well, it doesn't have to be necessarily one person, but people who can articulate right. the message and come up with really good programs or civil disobedience actions or whatever.
Yeah, so on the platform piece, that's just people not really paying attention. You can go to campaignzero.org and look at what some of the demands are. It's demilitarization of the police. It's an end to state-sanctioned murder and police brutality. A lot of programs involve, like, there's a books and breakfast program. That's an amazing program that Hands Up United has done in Ferguson. No one looks at those kinds of things. I mean, the demands are pretty clear. It's really about ending state-sanctioned violence against black folks, and that's about demilitarizing the police force. And it's also about changing, like, the construction of, like, jury policies and grand jury policies. There's detailed lists of things that they are demanding if people really want to do it. Now, the leadership thing is much more complex, right? Because throughout the history of dissent, we've had these male, singular, rhetorically gifted, you know, Erica Edwards has this great book called Charisma that talks about all these things. But those leaders have been assassinated, they've been co-opted. And so a decentralized leadership model, like the kind that you see with Dream Defenders or with Justice League in New York City, those things seem to be a little bit more effective for millennials. It's more effective in terms of how social media operates. It's more effective in terms of what they're trying to do. Now, long term, we kind of have to wait and see. But right now, when they look at that history of those singular, rhetorically gifted, charismatic leaders, they see assassinations, co-optation, and they see the failure of movements. So they're trying something different, and I don't know if we can judge them just yet until we see how these things shake out.
Let me read two emails. One from Joanne says, why protest at Bernie Sanders' event? One of the guests said that's the best place because he gets the biggest crowds. Did the organizers consider how taking on a civil rights activist like Bernie Sanders is actually offensive, even to those who are sympathetic to Black Lives Matter? An email from Rochelle. What I found disappointing with the August 8th confrontation with Bernie Sanders is that Senator Sanders failed to engage the women on the stage. He immediately became defensive, tried to put them off, if he had tried to connect with them, they might have come away feeling more validated. I mean, it's good. Dissent generates a lot of conversation.
Right. Yeah. And it would have been good if he could have taken them on. But as they themselves were saying, we're unreasonable.
Right.
And they were pretty much in your face. And when somebody's really in your face, it's very hard to listen. And it's very hard for the person who's in your face to listen. You know, that's one of the real skills that people have to have is when they're having a political argument, to be able to listen to the other person's point of view and to try to understand it, even if you completely disagree with it. And then if you try to understand it, there might be some little thing in there that makes sense to you, and it might alter the way you're thinking.
Again, like the Netroots Conference, the Seattle piece, these are progressive, traditionally progressive spaces where there's a lot of racial erasure. And so that frustration you're
meaning
seeing...
Meaning mostly white audience?
Mostly white audience, mostly white actors, but also they're diverse and slightly diverse, but the platforms aren't. And so again, don't think that these folks haven't mixed it up with Reverend Sharpton at his marches and his events. They have. They've done the same kinds of things. It just doesn't get the same kind of coverage. It doesn't get the same kind of outrage from white progressives. They targeted Sanders because he is the appropriate target. He's a leftist. They're trying to make him an authentic leftist who includes all the intersectional things that they're doing. It's not pretty, but it is what it is. And at the end
is
of the
day, working? I mean, it looks
it
like
is
it's
clearly working.
But that's because he's open to
exactly he's ideas. Open to it, and I think they should acknowledge that he's open to look at how his platform has changed. He has gone into much more detail about race. He's made it part of his stump speech to speak specifically to these things. Bernie Sanders as an individual and as a leader knows that they're right, otherwise he wouldn't have changed.
Ralph, let me put something to you, and then I do want to get back to our callers here. And I was thinking, as putting the my questions together, I was thinking about the killing, the murders, the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina, the young man that killed all those members of the AME church in Charleston. Out of that, the Confederate flag gets removed from the Capitol there, raising questions about, you know, how do you change things? And is it out of mourning and tragedy that people wake up to the sort of vestige of some of these racist symbols?
Well, unfortunately, that does seem to be the case a lot of the times. The thing, you know, that Confederate flag was flying, that they started that in, I think, around 1961 in response to the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. This was part of the white backlash against the Civil Rights Movement, part of what is some historians call the Second Reconstruction, and creating this sort of mythological view about what the Confederacy was all about and that the war was fought for states' rights and all that stuff. And I think it became very clear to people after this massacre that this, you know, this message that the state had been doing was getting through to lots of young, impressionable people as people are growing up and formulating their own political ideology. And then something like that happens.
Yeah. And I mean, the flag came down.
Yeah, after Bree Newsom took it down. After Bree Newsom took it down, yes, the flag ultimately did.
Yeah, but they, I mean, the official ceremony that,
yes,
that took it down.
Yeah, I'm still haunted by Charleston.
Oh, absolutely.
Just haunted by it. Yeah. And you know, for people who don't understand, I have always, my entire life, seeing the Confederate flag has always been a traumatic experience for me. Seeing it anywhere, as well, because I don't know if people get it. I mean, my ancestors were raped, murdered, and systematically exploited under the banner of that flag. And I don't have to go back too many generations to see that directly. And so I've always been offended. So just think of how many millions of Americans can have that black and white, can have that response to that image. It should have been gone a long time ago.
Let me get, looks like Lakshmi from Cherry Hill to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Lakshmi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
My question is that as somebody who's a supporter of the Black Lives Matter movement, but who's sort of like a typical suburban progressive, if you will, what can I do specifically to move this movement forward? What can I do, you know, from my suburban home, essentially?
Well, it's a good question. I'll toss that to. Do you want to take that, Ralph, first?
Well, I'll take it first. Yeah, it reminds me, back in 1967, I saw Stokely Carmichael give a talk at Michigan State University, and a white student asked him that same question: "What can I, as a white student, do, a white liberal, to help the Black Power movement?" And he said, what you can do is you don't join the movement. You don't come and tell us what to do. You don't work in the ghetto to, you know, be, you know, kind of co-opting it. What you do is you go into the white community and civilize the whites.
Same message today, then?
Yeah, I mean, it seems it's so. I think all activism works best where you are anyway. And so, yes, amongst your friends, are you in dialogue with your friends and with your family and with your extended network about these issues? Do you have the courage to talk about these things at work? You know, remember, activism takes place in sort of micro spaces. And so there's a way in which, you know, for people who have that kind of question, you know, you never want to give the sort of Malcolm X answer that there's plenty of things you can do. You can donate. You can follow along on social media, keep abreast of what the sort of platform is and what the stories are. You can attend the larger rallies, but we're just having so many problems with the whole allied movement and appropriation that I think the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to keep that a little bit at bay. But there's plenty for you to do in your own community, in your church, in your workplace, in your family. Speak to the people who are around you. Make sure that people are aware of what's going on, because sadly, you know, when something like Charleston happens or Mike Brown happens or Trayvon Martin happens, you know, for some of us, it's like traumatic. And it's just like, for me, I can't even sleep. I can't, you know, but for some folks, they can just go on about their daily lives. Are you capturing those folks in your circle to raise their consciousness and to challenge them to do the same things that I would challenge her to do, which is donate to these movements, be aware of them, and work within your own networks to make sure that that awareness is being raised in every way that you can.
Talk to your family, friends, and neighbors.
Basically, you can think globally but act locally. You know, one of the expressions that we always used to use.
I remember that expression very, very well. Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times, talking about Black Lives Matter. Ralph Young, professor of history at Temple University, author of a book called Dissent, The History of an American Idea. Also with us, James Peterson, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. You can check out his podcast here at WHYY, and it's called The Remix. Go to that's right, isn't it? Yes, it is. Okay.
It is.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marty.
The Remix. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of this program. You can also check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, a very lively discussion. And do stay with us for the second hour of the show. We'll be right back.